Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Blind Ambition with Jack Kelly. It's your friend Rick from Blind, and today I'm going to introduce you all to Leah Garvin. So Leah is the founder and CEO of the Workplace Reframe, which is a consulting and coaching service. It provides workshops, programs to support companies, executives, managers, leaders to build better teams, which, you know, after 3 years of a pandemic, after kind of the tumult of layoffs and return to office and work from home, I can see a lot of companies and a lot of people, a lot of our listeners needing your help. Leah, before she started that business, spent nearly 10 years in tech at Apple, Microsoft, and Google, most recently as the lead team operations and organizational effectiveness for the health and Google team at Alphabet. So thanks for coming on the show, Leah.
Thank you so much for having me. Super excited to be here.
So, hey, just to kick it off, Leah, with the different, you know, we talked a little bit before the show, and I kind of love the work you did. If I went to tech, I would do it. It's maybe you could share a little bit with the audience, because they think of, like software engineers, software developers, but you have kind of a different role. So maybe you could kind of talk about, as a project manager type person, what you do and some of the successes you had with these great companies.
Yeah. So, you know, as you mentioned, I worked in program management and in team operations. And so essentially that's really about how the work gets done. And I came into that sort of unintentionally. I think not everybody seeks out being a program manager, but I think I actually, funny enough, got recruited to Microsoft from LinkedIn. It was literally, I found the email in my spam folder and I was like, what's this? And I actually responded and ended up moving to Seattle by myself like a year after I got married. My husband was still in San Francisco. And I took this job to work in kind of a program management function. I had never really heard about it. But I had been doing project management in design companies and different things like that. And essentially the work is really about, you know, connecting the dots between teams, like between design and product and engineering around how work is going to get done. So product manager is really looking at product strategy, design, and engineering is really kind of creating and building. But a program manager is really mapping out, you know, what are the risks? What do we need to figure out to be able to get there? And what's the schedule? What are the moving pieces? And really being there as that glue across these different roles and functions. And at first, you know, I felt like, you know, as I learned about this work and started to dive into it and was surrounded by engineers and product people and designers, I felt like, you know, should I go back to school? Like I should be an engineer. I'm not technical enough. And I had all these imposter feelings for a long time trying to figure out, you know, how do I really add value in this company? I mean, this summary of what a program manager is, I can say now 10 years after, but like at the time I was like, you know, well, people don't really know what my role is. And, you know, I feel like I can't really debate issues with engineers. I didn't understand all the, you know, technical details. And I think what I leaned into though, from the start that ended up really shaping this career was like a real passion for understanding people and dynamics that are at play on a team. And when work wasn't getting done or deadlines were missed or things were slowing down, it wasn't because we didn't have the right team members. It wasn't because people weren't skilled or technical enough or, you know, even, you know, driven or motivated. It was actually, there was some interpersonal thing in the way. Like they weren't clear on expectations or they weren't involved in a certain meeting that, you know, they didn't know what the decision was, or, you know, they didn't get the feedback they needed about something that was happening. And I started to build this hypothesis that actually, in order to actually manage projects and work and schedules, you had to figure out all this personal stuff first. And so that's what I really started to bring into how it would work. And in doing that, I was able to really rally people around, you know, timelines that felt really, really aggressive around, you know, getting. One of the first things that I did on the HoloLens team at Microsoft was getting all of our design work from being tracked on like post-its and like loose, you know, like notes and whatever in people's heads into using, you know, Visual Studio, where engineering was tracking all their work. And I'll tell you, like, designers don't want to track their work in an engineering system, but and really getting people bought in around what's in it for them, why, how it's going to make their life easier, and showing people like I'm actually really invested in them and care about them and entering some of the tasks for them. To be honest, to get started, like I could get people to really shift the way they were working in a way that made more sense by using these tools of building relationship first.
Do you think, Leah, was it harder or easier by being a woman in this role?
You know, I think it's a really tough role to be a woman in this program management space. And a lot of the folks that I worked with at Google, a lot of people I managed at Google as program managers were women that were wrestling with, you know, I have to have this role of being holding people accountable and mitigating risk. And yet I'm navigating and maybe being one of the less technical people in the conversation. And then I'm navigating some of these biases and double standards of like not wanting to be a complainer or emotional or whatever. And so I think it makes it really tough. And some of the things that I started to do and what I coached a lot of the folks that I worked with on was, say, two things. One was really shifting this framing of accountability from like, I'm telling you what to do. You got to, you know, like sort of like a, I don't know, like blame punishment lens into ownership and reframing like, hey, when you need to finish something, it's because it's your job. It's your responsibility. It's not like because I asked you to do it. And so I would remind people to shift language from like, hey, I need you to finish this deliverable by 2 p.m. to, you know, this needs to be sent to engineering by 2 o'clock, you know, let me know if there's a delay, you know what I mean? And so using like, I need you to do this, that kind of language is going to make it even harder. It's not a personal favor for you to do your job, right? Like, no, that's your responsibility. So I think that was one big shift. And then also really speaking in terms of risk management. So I think, you know, we're taught all sorts of things about how to communicate to get people to listen, but like say, you know, in a personal relationship saying like, I felt this, you know, this is why that works there. Not at work. Okay. Not like I felt this because it's like, hey, the project is at risk. Here are the reasons. So to really depersonalize, I think that's a thing that any gender can be doing, especially for women, not to bring in, over-identify with the situation, to over-personalize with it, because I think it puts you in a little bit of a defense state. So one example is I was working with a design director who was really, really concerned about her team. They were working on a project that like really should have had 40 designers on it, but it had 5 designers. And I think they were working with like 100 engineers, like some really, really skewed ratio, right? It was impossible the amount of work they had. And so people were starting to burn out. People were calling in sick a lot, and she was really worried about the team. And this design director and I were talking about how she was going to ask for more headcount. And she said, you know, I'm going to go to the engineering VP and say, I'm really worried about the team. I can't have the team being this burned out. Like people are burning, you know, I really want us to focus on well-being. Well-being is important. And I was like, no, like none of that's going to land. And I'm sorry. Like I want us all to care about well-being. It's important. We believe that. And what messaging is going to land for this engineering VP? Well, what does that person care about? They care about the product shipping on time. That's like the number one priority, like everything else. So how do you speak in terms of that? Well, let's talk in terms of risk management. If we have 5 people, each one carries 20% of the load. And if you lose one person, you only have 80% of the output. And if you lose 2, you have 60. Let's frame in terms of risk management. And hey, what are the trade-offs? Like, what is the plan if we lose a person? Like, I want to just talk about it. And when she framed this risk that way, then she was able to get 2 more headcount. If she had said, I'm worried about my team, everyone is burning out, this leader, maybe they would care, but not really. I'm sorry to say, like, I think that's the state we're in. We recognize like doesn't really, you know, land with many executives about individual well-being. I think a lot of it is, you know, when it comes down to, it's about dollars and cents and shipping and landing these timelines. So I really encourage folks to speak in terms of risk management, and the whole conversation changes. you don't feel like, oh, the person didn't care about me and my argument. It's like, hey, we're talking about this objectively. Do we agree or not?
Elliot, did anyone give you coaching for these jobs, or did they just throw you into the fire and then you got to figure this out yourself?
I would say throw me in the fire.
You know, I think, because that's hard. Because like just to figure out how to navigate difficult personalities, that's not an easy thing to do.
No, and I didn't get it right a lot at the beginning, especially. I think it was from learning, like, when I said something like, I'm really worried about the team, and someone just gave me a blank stare, like, sorry, that's their job, right? Like, I sort of started to see what were the ways I was communicating that were actually influencing people in you know, the right direction versus were resulting in feedback like, you're complaining or you're not a team player, right? Like, so it took a lot of, I think, like deep self-reflection and looking at, hey, what didn't land about this conversation? What wasn't working here? And the sort of continual drive though, to make the way we were working better. So it was like, instead of getting discouraged and being like, screw this place, like saying like, okay, like I need to try a different approach because I know that this is necessary.
Yeah. Like Leah, how does it work when you actually have a product to deliver? You know, where I guess with Blind is more of a service, but you actually have like a headset, AR, VR, right? I mean, it's a physical, tangible thing. Does that make a big difference?
So it's been really interesting to watch which teams have been really eager to come back, which versus not. And I think to your point, I've seen a lot more enthusiasm from hardware teams where there's like a physical product to work on to be back together. And some teams that I worked with, at Google throughout the pandemic were the ones that had something like they were maybe coming in still during the pandemic. They had maybe special exceptions or they came back earlier or whatever. And they had, you know, there was a excitement around that. I think when you have the physical thing, it's like, it makes more sense to folks like, okay, I need to touch the thing. I need to see the thing and whatever. But with this, with services and with software, I have seen it be a lot more challenging for teams. I think what we all have to be doing is being intentional about like, what are the working norms, the communication norms for all the things, like literally rethinking every aspect of the way that we're working. Because I think just having a bunch of problems in interpersonal, like, you know, communication around team communication, unclear expectations, overlapping role responsibilities, a lack of feedback, not a lot of trust in the people working on the right things. If you think RTO is going to solve that, it's not. You have those same issues. Just people are like bitter because they were forced to come back. So like, I think first you want to figure out, how do we address all of these things? How do we build a stronger culture of feedback and, you know, having feedback be a two-way street and psychological safety? How do we figure out communication norms, as Rick called out, across time zones, disseminating information, communicating decisions? How do we, you know, make sure, how do we understand how we do want to track progress against things so that we're not monitoring people, but we do understand, you know, hey, like we need to know what the status of things is. Like where folks are working all over the world. Like we got to solve all that. And then this is what I work a lot with teams on in my consulting work is, how do we figure out what we actually want as a team or as leaders or as business owners, whatever. And then what are the supporting processes that we want to put in place? I think a lot of times people jump to the process without actually thinking, what actually do we want? What are we solving for? What is the ideal situation? So like getting our head around that, then figuring out what processes support it, but being light, having a light touch with process. I mean, you know, my whole career has been built on establishing processes, and I'm like very anti like over heavy-handed processes. I see processes about like simplifying, removing steps, kind of shortening the line of communication, making sure, you know, we are very, very clear, as opposed to like building, like it shouldn't solve for everything at once. It should have like one clear purpose, I think, for processes. So when we do that, now we've sort of solved all the like stuff in the ether that's clouding a decision on return to office. Then we're saying, okay, if we really want people to be together, because we know that it helps people kind of band together to rise to the occasion for some of these big milestones, we know it builds community. We know it does improve engagement. There's a lot of evidence around all those things, being co-located, you know, feelings of isolation. There's different things. Then we figure out, well, what are the moments to bring people together? And is it, it's probably more than once a year, to be honest, if it's possible with, you know, budget wise, I think it's, you know, but it may be, it's probably not every day. And so I think there can be a real balance of what we figure out after we've solved for the problems. Because I was recently reading a New York Times article about one of the gaps with, you know, not being co-located was, especially for younger folks, like your first experience in the workplace, you're not getting that quick feedback of like, hey, how does this thing work? Or like, where do I find this? So you're just like having a lot of downtime, like just like looking through documents and files and like, just like kind of floundering. And I've seen that a lot in the beginning of the pandemic with especially this explosive growth in tech, working from home in the pandemic, like that was a weird time to be joining a company and you don't really get integrated in the culture. But actually what we can be doing is figuring out a better onboarding system. You know, we can have buddies, you can figure out chat channels and maybe onboarding cohorts and different things like to make sure people have those forums. And then we say, okay, people have gotten this like foundation. Now, how do we bring people together?
That's really interesting. So from what I understand, you know, pivoting from big tech, you're actually providing consulting services, not a big tech.
Yeah.
Like, are there any new vibes or directions, anything that you've seen is changing, whether, you know, we talked about remote work, but anything that jumps out?
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, it's been really interesting to have this different sort of, you know, a way to interact very differently. Like as a someone outside in, you're invited into the conversation. You're not like shouting from the mountaintops inside, like, listen to me, this is important. So that's been awesome to be able to have, you know, hey, I am inviting the conversation. Here's some things I've observed using the same framework of here's some risks, here's some ideas, bringing solutions. And then seeing, you know, where people are at as far as, you know, wanting to, you know, try things out. I think for bigger companies, there is an understanding of, you know, I think the need to get better at things like feedback and manager development. Those are the main, some of the main things that I support people on because, you know, managers are kind of at the front lines of all this stuff, like middle managers are figuring out their own jobs and supporting their teams and all these things with return to office. And so that's where I spend a lot of my time. It's what my podcast, Managing Simple, is about. But for smaller businesses, I think there's a new understanding of like, they actually, like a small business owner with a team, they're a manager. I don't think they even thought of themselves that way. Like, yeah, you're a manager if people, you have employees. So helping, I think small business owners too, to understand what their role is and that all these things that we talk about in bigger companies, they have to do too. You have to give feedback. You have to set expectations. You have to, you know, help people understand the link between priorities and expectations and compensation. All of that is stuff that I also support teams with because I think everybody, no matter what industry you're in, is facing like a low engagement, low motivation moment where we're all having to re-energize people around their work.
Now, I'm curious, you mentioned that a lot of what prevents organizations, companies, teams from performing at their best is actually not, you know, the hard skills, but these interpersonal relationships or interpersonal like communication. You know, you've worked across different industries, financial services, scientific research, nonprofit world, design, certainly big tech. Do you see any trends that are specific to one type of job function, one type of industry, or is this a universal problem that we just need to all get better at as humans?
I think a lot of it is a universal problem, to be honest.
Oh, no.
Because I've observed the same kind of issues working with like a client that runs a med spa as I saw at Google, you know what I mean? Wow. Like those are very different, right? Someone that's, you know, runs someone that administers Botox and someone that's building a search engine. So I think, you know, when you take a step back, it's like, do people really understand how to be successful in their work? And have we given them all the tools to do that? Like that's really how I look at it from a macro lens. And what I think as I've used these similar tools in these different forums, I've seen, wow, like this really does like apply across the board. Because, you know, take for example, the application of it looks different. So for example, like I was doing a workshop last year on psychological safety with a law firm on psychological safety and failure. And it's like fail fast, not a vibe for a law firm, right? Like,
right.
You know, there's like a real, it's not the same as with tech. So I think the costs are very different by industry, but when you find out, when you figure out like, well, what are in this specific scenario, right? Like what are the real like risks and concerns that people have both for their own job safety, but also for like whatever service or work that they're doing. When you understand that, then you can still translate these kind of principles across the board. Because for this law firm, the facts are people still are going to make mistakes, right? People still are going to have to learn from each other. But saying, trivializing it and saying like, just like, you know, fail fast if that client, you know, goes to prison, like what I was like, no, the stake. So you want to recognize the stakes and you want to recognize the context. And then I think share, well, how do you apply some of these tools even in that environment? So, you know, another example, like my cousin is a, you know, an estimator in an electrician firm, right? It's very different than like the kind of stuff that I talked about at Google, but he still deals with motivation, employee turnover, demanding deadlines, you know, not having enough resources, dealing with like economic shifts. So we're all dealing with the same kinds of things, but how they show up can impact us a lot differently.
What are some concrete steps that, you know, if you're an individual contributor, or maybe you're an early people manager and, you know, your first instinct is to go to that CTO, is to go to that VP of engineering and say, you know, I'm advocating for my team. I'm, you know, I'm being a good team member. I'm being a good manager and saying, hey, my folks are in the foxhole. We're burning out. How do you change that kind of communication style or that kind of framework in terms of how one is failing to being more objective or thinking through a risk management lens?
Yeah. So I would say to first slow down and kind of watch your reactivity, because thinking of like, so I mentioned the example I gave at with the design director. This was in my later, you know, time in tech, in my like year one. I remember I said, you know, I had said all that we were coming in every weekend for a number of months and to ship this project. And in one of my reviews with design engineering, the engineering manager said like a lot of people were on vacation. And so we had to move the deadline. And I was like, what the hell? Like we've been coming in every single weekend. And you didn't even tell me everyone's going on vacation. Like I should have let my team. And I like flipped out and everybody just looked at me like, you know, and it was like, didn't land. Okay. And in the moment I was very frustrated. We were all exhausted. And I felt like I was the sucker who was telling people to come in, and I was going to go to my team and say like, actually, like what I've been saying, you know, we're not all applying this the same way. And I don't think that's the way to react, right? So like, because it didn't even help, you know, people were just like, oh, what's her deal? And it, you know, what I would have said is actually what I then coached this person, you know, on like 8 or 9 years later around talking about, like thinking about what is the message that person on the other side will respond best to. So I think it's really like coaching yourself and saying, okay, what am I feeling? Think about it, letting that be okay, you know, having that, but then like taking a deep breath and trying to approach the conversation when you're not in a state of feeling frustrated or reactive or, you know, high emotions, so that you can actually communicate what you want from something and you can be more solutions oriented. And I think this is something that is really important in any job when you're communicating, especially in tech, that when you're communicating with senior stakeholders, executives that aren't going to read a 10-page email, that are going to read one sentence, you know what I mean? That like, you have to be really, really concise around like, here's the issue. Here is an idea I have. Any feedback? Like, I would just use that framework. Problem, idea/solutions, feedback. So you're always leading with, I'm not just starting shit and I'm just like leaving a problem on your lap to fix. But I'm not ignoring, I'm not unaware there's a problem. I'm giving you some solutions and I'm leaving the door open for you to kind of give me a yes, no, or let's adjust. So that's what I'd recommend to folks, both ICs and managers that are trying to influence is, you know, feel the feels, all good. And then think about, you know, what is the way to objectively communicate this? So, you know, we have a risk. Folks are starting to call out sick. People are demonstrating, you know, burnout, you know, sort of like behaviors. This is concerning for the timeline of the project. Never said the word I, right? So I was just, here are some suggestions that I have. Grabbing some resources off this other project, but tag teaming people, like, you know, shifting this one deliverable to Q2, whatever. And then would love to hear your feedback. Right now you've really depersonalized it and you've forwarded the conversation where, you know, you're looking like someone that's like an idea person instead of a problem starter.
You know, it makes a lot of sense. And one of the things that you mentioned really resonated with me, running a business early on, I fell into this trap that you just mentioned that, what, you know, that happened to you, is that generally I'm a very calm person, you know, thoughtful, logical, but I don't know if you guys do this, but then things build up, right? Like,
yeah.
I let it go. And then just someone could say something innocuous, you know, like really not much. And then I go like, you know, and it just all comes pouring out. And then like, as I'm doing it, I realize, oh my gosh. Because then it happened, it's like kind of often. So like, I'm doing it again. And yes. It's like, why can't I not learn to stop doing that?
Yeah.
And it really took a while for me to just be able to address the small incremental things at a time instead of letting it build up and have that explosion. Because that's the worst thing to do. Because even if you're right, you're going to be the jerk by just,
exactly,
you know, telling that engineer, you know what, you know, blah, 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 you should have been there, you should do it. Because it's just always going to come back to you as the bad guy or bad woman, you know?
Exactly. And that's one of the biggest lessons. It's like, in corporate world and capitalism, it's not about who's right. Like, let's be real. Like, it has like very little to do with being right. It's like, have you landed the point well? Have you brought people along? Have you? So when you get fixated on proving, and this is a huge, huge thing, I think everybody to think about, it's like, especially if you have a lot of empathy, if you're a highly sensitive person, which I for sure am, like where you're like reading, like, oh, something's not right here. Like, convincing and proving is not the route to getting people on your side. It's really not. It's about, you know, bring people along, building relationships, talking about, hey, here's some things I'm seeing, like letting that sit, letting people kind of reach that in their own, you know, terms. Because when you get in this space of having to prove it and having an impatience around that, that's where what you're talking about, where you're kind of like always boiling over, because it is very frustrating when these issues persist that you've tried to be, you know, that you feel are so clear. I mean, you can hear how, you know, passionate I am about it, but it's like, this is one of the biggest lessons I think we can learn, is that just because we're right, or just because we think we've proven something, it doesn't mean people are going to agree or change their approach. There's a lot of dynamics at play. You know, I think a lot of us look around in a team we're in and we see like someone that's not pulling their weight, right? We've all been there. But kind of like throwing that person on the bus over and over and being trying to expose that person, oh, that does not work. It doesn't. And, you know, I think, you know, having a private one-on-one conversation with the manager saying, hey, like, I'm kind of concerned about this. Sure, you should absolutely share feedback. But like going on a mission to have that person kind of take them down, like, I think there's sometimes people can feel like it's their, you know, like life's purpose to prove this injustice. And that can actually work against you. And I've had it happen to me. And I feel like that's something that I learned that I really had to let go of, that like, hey, this person doesn't see it this way. Maybe there's more to the story, that the person that I think is terrible has some value they're bringing, or the manager isn't going to get headcount and they've decided it's more valuable to have someone in that role, even if the person sucks, than have no one, or whatever it is. We can't just prove and think it's going to be fixed.
Yeah, I'll go back to when you said you had imposter syndrome because you didn't have an MBA or you weren't a coder. But I would say this, and I'm not saying this to be nice, I'm just being frank. It seems the skills that you've honed are hard. I mean, like you would need it. It's almost like you made your own MBA program, you know, by learning on your own. Because for people who may not be in the kind of role you are, they don't get how hard it is to just navigate those channels every day, all the time, all day long. I mean, it's a really highly focused skill set to keep.
Thank you.
If you have like 10, you know, people that you have to kind of please and get aboard, that's not easy. Think about it. In real life, Rick, think about it. How hard is it to get a group of friends to agree where to go out to eat or go to a movie? It's so hard to get everybody to buy in, let alone where you have these people who all feel they're right. I know what's best. Who are you to tell me? And then you have to kind of massage that. Though that's really hard to do.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think it's a lot of it is having to sort of put aside that we were just talking about, like, you know, what you want or think or what you feel should be easier, which was like a constant, you know, frustration and struggle, but something I had to keep working on is like, you know, this, it should be, I sent out the spreadsheet, they should all put in their tracked work and it should be take 5 seconds, but they didn't fill it out. So like, you know, there's like always anything, okay, how else can I do this? And I agree. I think it is, it can be really underestimated the amount of work and skill that goes into being able to really navigate these organizational dynamics. And I think why I really love being a consultant now, because I think I can be utilizing these skills all of the time. And it's something that's sort of gets to be like celebrated and what makes me successful, as opposed to sometimes feeling like, oh, you know, this sort of spidey sense I have about a situation is being like something I should just ignore because no one's going to listen. You know what I mean? So it's like, it has been really, I think moving into being a consultant, I've been able to really, you know, re-own these skills and re-own this appreciation for the approach that I brought to the work.
No, I think that's quite interesting because I think we often don't think about what motivates or how other folks are incentivized, right? So like, you know, I early on in my career, I used to get in those traps. Maybe you have gotten in those traps too, Leah, of like, oh gosh, like I wouldn't tell an engineer how to code. Why are they telling me how to do my job, right? Or why are they micromanaging me?
Yeah.
Or, you know, what's going on there? And kind of taking that step back now with that objectivity, like you mentioned, and saying like, oh no, they're actually just trying to bring me along. They want to like double check because they don't know my function, right? And they're trying to do it maybe in a weird way, but they're trying.
Yeah, exactly. And I think part of that is, you know, in some sense, like assuming good intent but I think it's, we get there a lot faster when we've built a relationship with people, which then comes back to how we're supporting that in a team or company when maybe it's harder because we're not co-located. So, you know, I think that's what we're seeing in the power of, you know, even if you go, if you meet with your team in person once every quarter, like right after you've seen someone in person and laughed with them or had a meeting, like the kind of compassion you have for them is a lot higher than if you've never met them. Like really, it's really powerful. And assuming the, you know, positive tenor, knowing, oh, this person's invested in me, like, I get it. Like that does go a long way. And so I think when we're not in a situation where we can meet in person, doing, you know, focusing on things as a team, like how to build psychological safety, how to get some vulnerability out there. There's a lot of workshops and exercises that I bring to teams and that are out there that are really powerful for doing that, to getting to know people. That's going to help you see like, okay, this person does care about me. This person's, you know, this person, we have the same goals. They are invested in my success in some sense. So this piece of feedback wasn't because they're nitpicky or think I'm an idiot. It's because like, yeah, we're on the same page. And so I think when I talk about how to give feedback, one of the questions I ask people to ask themselves is, am I the right person to give this feedback? And, you know, how we get to a yes or no is, have I actually built a relationship with this person? Does this person know that I'm invested in them? And if not, we're probably not the one to give them that feedback. You know, there's moments when, you know, if someone is, you know, standing up like as an ally or something like that, then I think it's definitely warranted. But if it's something like, hey, that presentation could have been better, something like that, where it's like, I've never met that person. I'm just like, sprinkling my opinions around, like, no. So I think the first thing we got to do with our teams is take active work to build relationships. And I mean, Jack, you mentioned like, is this work hard to do remotely? Yeah. I mean, a lot of the work that I did since moving, you know, since the beginning of COVID and the last, you know, 3 years it was in tech was like having one-on-ones, building relationships, being way more proactive with building relationships and meeting with people than, you know, than I felt like I had time for, or maybe was comfortable at times. I changed teams twice while I was remote. So having to like reach out, hey, I'm new. I'd love to chat. I'd love to learn about work. That stuff's not always easy, right? It could be feel I'd rather, you know, go take a walk than have like 4 15-minute one-on-ones maybe, but it's very, very worth the investment of building relationships, of getting to know people when you can't be in person, even if it can feel a little exhausting. Maybe you make a goal when you start a team to do it for, you know, 2-3 weeks, really like power through, and then maybe you lighten up the load, just because it's so invaluable when you've made that time to connect with people.
Leah, what would you suggest for people who are remote and pretend, you know, let's say they're younger and they need a mentor, they need a sponsor, they just want to just speak to people, like see people in real life. Like, how can they reach out? Because especially if someone's introverted, it's hard to do. Like, what would you recommend? How can they kind of get to forge those early, you know, relationships that'll grow throughout their career?
Yeah, I love that question. I think one thing is, you know, when you're in a meeting, if someone shares something, an interesting idea or question, sending that person an email after and saying, hey, I love that point you made in the meeting, or saying like, you know, something like that. I'd love to connect 15 minutes and get to know, you know, about your work a little bit more. I think so, following up with like a hook of something that, you know, a little bit of recognition that you saw the person already. I think that's one. Another, a lot of teams and companies do things like informal coffee chats or whatever. I think like constraining that to like a 15-minute chat is really helpful. I think it can be hard for people to give you 30, 45 an hour, right? Yeah. So if you say, hey, can I grab 10 minutes and learn more about you? Or, you know, I'm new, I'm just kind of trying to absorb things, and just asking for a small amount of time, I think that's easier. And most folks will give that. I've built some of my closest relationships with folks when I was at Google that I've never met in person. By, you know, someone I was interviewing for a role, and she didn't end up being a fit. And she wrote after like, hey, like, I love talking to you. Like, let's connect again. It was like the awesomest thing. And we ended up meeting weekly for like 2 years after that. So I think to not get in your head about, oh, this person doesn't want to hear from me or whatever. Like, if you connect with someone or get a good vibe with someone, to definitely follow up. I think all of us are seeking more connection. And then if you're not in those forums, so like, let's say, you know, looking in the company directory and looking for people with similar roles and doing a similar approach, sending someone an email and saying, hey, I'm trying to build my relationships or network. Do you have, you know, 10 minutes you can spare to just connect? And I'd love to learn more about your work. I think the similar approach can work. Just again, I think the catch really is asking for less time up front. Maybe you build a relationship, but I think sometimes where people get like turned off from it is when you just kind of blindly throw 30 minutes on the calendar or an hour. And, you know, it's like, if you have all these questions, like throttle it, you can have more than one meeting, but, you know, we're all strapped for time. So, you know, having a little bit of a chunk that you're asking for.
Wow. I appreciate these things because, you know, it's almost like great software or great tech, right? When you see it in its final form, you think, oh, wow, this is so simple, it's so easy to use. But obviously, it's so complex to build and like train those muscles and get there. And I really appreciate this masterclass, Leah, of how we can create, and this is just not just leaders or the executives that are listening, but everyone create this like team culture that produces like engagement, and that it's like the interpersonal understanding and just like the better kind of profitability of life, but also business. So, yeah. So thanks for coming on the show and sharing that with us.
Yeah, thank you. And I think, you know, that is why my podcast is Managing Made Simple, because it is simple, like you say, Rick. And it's, I think we're all complex people, but the solutions and what we want to do, it's simple and we kind of get out of our own way. So yeah, it's really important to me to bring people very simple actions they can try and then supporting them for kind of wrestling with the like inner stuff that makes it harder. But what we have to do, it's pretty simple.
Love that reminder. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks so much.
That's it for The Blind Ambition. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.